Welcome back. I'm Nathaniel R., your host of the Film Experience. You've reached part two of Supporting Actress SmackDown of 1977. In the first installment, I welcomed our panel, which this time is Guy Lodge from Variety, Nick Davis, professor at Northwestern University, Sarah Black McCullough, freelance researcher and writer, and Mark Harris, author of Pictures at a Revolution, and of course myself, Nathaniel, to discuss the supporting actress nominees of 1977 and our memories from that year. Or rather, our memories about the films of that year, since not the entire panel was alive back then. In the first installment, we talked about Fred Zinnemann's Julia with Jane Fonda and Vanessa Redgrave, and Neil Simon's The Goodbye Girl. Before we move into our final three movies, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Close Encounters, and The Turning Point, Mark has one last anecdote about The Goodbye Girl, and you're going to want to hear this. Enjoy part two of our podcast.
Do people know the interesting backstory of this movie? Because I've been working on this Mike Nichols biography, and this film actually originated several years earlier as a movie called Bogart Slept Here, where it was gender flipped. Essentially, it was much more the story of the husband who leaves than of the wife and daughter he leaves behind, and it starred Robert De Niro, and Nichols actually got several days into shooting, and I know it's strange, but he got days into shooting and then walked away because he said, he actually shut the film down because he said this doesn't work, like this is just not going to work. And that story in turn was apparently based in part on a story that Dustin Hoffman had told about how he knew his marriage was over the minute he got the star role in The Graduate, or and that his wife knew the marriage was over before he did. So it has The Goodbye Girl has a long history that goes like into a famous movie from 10 years earlier, and it was probably a very good instinct on Neil Simon's part to flip it and realize that it is actually it should be the story of the woman, not the man.
That, I mean, yeah, that makes it even more 70s, so I cherish that anecdote. Because then that connects to all sorts of movies and things that were going on at the time.
There aren't many movies about which I'd say I'm really glad they went with Richard Dreyfuss instead of Robert De Niro, but because it's quite funny. This was the first time I'd seen this movie, and I was expecting, given kind of its reputation, to find Richard Dreyfuss really annoying and the other, the two female leads to be lifelines. I say leads because Quinn Cummings just about is. I mean, it's really a three-hand. And yet, I actually quite enjoyed his kind of mania throughout the film and found and struggled much more with the other two. I thought, in particular, Marsha Mason, even though, obviously she was Neil Simon's partner, I thought she seemed especially ill at ease with the language of it.
I mean, I a lot of like the Neil Simon and Marsha Mason movies I saw when I was quite young, not when they came out, but like on VHS when I was like exploring Inside Oscar, which we keep bringing up. And I was really, when I was young, I was really into them. I think because they're very easy watches compared to some other, like, more challenging movies. And, like, I was obsessed with Chapter 2 and, like, those
Oh my
things.
God.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Sorry, I'm not trying to judge you.
I was young. We all make mistakes. But I, like, yeah, I mean, there are things about those movies that I really love, and even when some of the performances are awkward, I do find them quite funny. Like I loved Marsha Mason's, like when she's like, "You can go back to dancing," and she was like, "I can't even walk. I'm 33 or whatever," which to me was hilarious. Maybe because I'm getting older, it was just super funny, like how much people like feel their body betrays them, even as young as that. So I had somewhere where I was going with this, but oh, I Richard Dreyfuss. So like I find it interesting that he won the Oscar for this, because to me it's I understand why guy you would enjoy the mania, but to me it was just too much. I mean, it's like a manic actor playing a manic actor.
Yeah.
So it was like a double whammy of it. Whereas I think he's just brilliant in Close Encounters.
Yeah.
And his pairing with both Melinda Dillon and Terry Garr is so interesting to me in Close Encounters, even though it's not an actor's movie per se.
Mm-hmm.
Because Terry Garr is actually can be such a manic performer, and he's so much less. I don't know. Like he's so toned down in Close Encounters, even though the character goes through this sort of mania episode.
Mm.
I just think it's a really interesting performance, and this is probably the least I've enjoyed Close Encounters in the many times I've seen it this particular viewing for some reason. Mostly because I was watching it, I think, specifically for the acting this time, and
yeah.
I got bored toward the end, which I don't normally, because I felt like, oh, enough with the aliens, you know?
Yeah.
I want to know about these people. I want to know about these people.
That's a hard position from which to watch Close Encounters.
Yeah.
God, who cares? Aliens, whatever.
So, but I, because I did feel like the first half, like Melinda and Richard were doing really interesting character work that I feel like the movie became less and less interested in, which was the harder thing for me this time. So I'm wondering if anybody else feels like the movie sort of loses them or stops challenging them halfway through.
Yeah, I definitely felt that once they kind of knew what direction that they were going towards, I guess you called it the Death Tower. I don't know what that's called that they're looking for. I just found that it completely...
Is it Devil's Tower? Like
Devil's Tower? Yeah, I forget.
Does anybody know?
The tower that Richard Dreyfuss keeps sort of building out of mashed potatoes.
Right. I think it is called Devil's Tower.
Devil's Tower. I just feel like it completely fizzles. I can't remember who brought this up, but someone... I think it was Guy who had brought up, you know, the women in Spielberg cinema. I feel that the minute sort of the intentions for why they're both going there are sort of set, which is that... You know, she's looking for her son, but he's sort of trying to figure out if there's like greater meaning to the aliens. She kind of just fizzles out completely, and it was very. And I thought that, like, just as I was getting really invested in her character, she just sort of like, you know, the minute she's reunited with her son, we don't really hear from or see from her that much, and that's what really frustrated me. And Spielberg does this a lot with women, but I noticed that a lot more watching this, and I hadn't noticed it before. In other previous viewings of this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he does tend to... Maybe that's just him with the actors in general, but I think he does tend to, you know, peter out on the character arcs a little bit.
Yeah.
The romantic kind of subplot between Dreyfuss and Melinda Dillon seems particularly out of nowhere and then away just as soon as it's dropped in.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Like, that kiss comes out of nowhere and it's like... Okay.
Yeah, it's very out of place.
But you know, just in defense of this, because I hadn't seen it in many, many, many years, and I really was unexpectedly delighted to revisit it because it's so much more kind of human and optimistic. And I mean, compared to blockbusters that followed it or genre films that followed it, I mean, you can say that like plot arc is lost or abandoned. On the other hand, like, there is a woman in this movie. Like, that idea, you know, seemed to be completely lost by the 80s or 90s when Simpson Bruckheimer and Michael Bay started redefining, you know, large-scale action and science fiction. One thing I love about it, and I think it connects to Dreyfuss and Melinda Dillon, is this feeling that, like, okay, so this is a movie about aliens coming. Therefore, it could really be a movie about any characters on Earth where they're coming reacting. So why these characters? There's this lovely sort of understated thing that there's something a little missing in all of their lives to begin with. Like,
yes,
Richard Dreyfuss, I mean, obviously with Melinda Dillon, you have another kind of single parent story, again, like that 70s obsession with that. But also with Richard Dreyfuss, I was fascinated by the fact that he seemed like an odd fit in his own family from the very start. Like,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, I kind of get why he goes off with the aliens at the end, which is something that Spielberg said he never would have done after he became a parent. He never would have ended a movie with a parent abandoning his family. But when you watch the movie, you sort of get it, because you kind of feel like, yeah, maybe he belongs with them more than with these people the
other totally. Yeah.
Fit with. And with Melinda Dillon, just to get to her, you kind of feel like she's so weird and unearthly and kind of haunted by something that you kind of get, like, yeah, the aliens would totally spot her, you know?
Yeah.
Or come back for her.
It's true. That's actually one reason why I love the first half of the movie so much, is that they're sort of longing. You feel like it was maybe always there, this longing for the other, something otherworldly, because, like, the drawings and the sculptures and all that is such an interesting drama, right? Because it's so weird and inchoate. Like, it's like they're reaching for something and they don't know what it is. And maybe the movie doesn't even know what it is, but also doesn't think it's important, as long as that they're actually, like, reaching for it.
And then they're even willing to structure the movie in a way that's strange and inchoate in ways mm-hmm. that I think are really brave, you know, that you just pause for quite a while on things that don't, that remain ineffable, even at the end of an 8-minute sequence, and then race through some things that you think might take longer. But but it does seem like kind of a missed opportunity that, and I think I'm mostly agreeing here with Sarah, that there'd be quite a lot to play to watch this woman who is simultaneously negotiating the loss of her child, and maybe, or maybe not, imagining that there's even a prospect he'll come back, if that's what she's identifying in this ship coming back, while also being swept up enough in all of this, as she has been early in the movie, that she's feeling kind of pulled into the spectacular and historic cosmic scale of all of it. And if one felt like it's pulling away from the other, it seems like the movie set up to give her more to play, but instead it kind of elects to give her less.
Yeah.
And even to the extent of, like, I want to go down there.
Yes.
I'm good. I'm just going to hang out at the Rock. But you do it. You know, like, okay. See you, Melinda Dillon. Like, right. You'll be down here if you want to get back in it. Like,
Well,
it's sort of an emigration story, ultimately. Except it's an emigration story about the people left behind. Like,
yeah.
You know, because it really is, you strongly get the sense that, like, okay, so these people at the very end are going to a better place. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's like a sort of deeply, it's the story of America, but it kind of, it flips it so that, you know, what if America was the old country, the old world, mm-hmm. and we're seeing sort of the last American story, this is, or the first story of going to a better world. I found that just, maybe because I had just watched The Emigrants and The New Land, I found that really interesting and unexpected and almost kind of subversive for a 1977 movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's actually one of my favorite Spielberg movies, like way up there, like in my top three of his work, because of that, because it's so open-ended and doesn't, it challenges you in ways that his movies later never did. I described it as like an ink blot in his in a library full of how-to manuals for him, because I just feel like it's one of his, it's definitely his most open movie in terms of, like, what you can feel about it. He's not, you know, telling you what you have to feel ever, basically, other than the sense of awe, you know.
It's why I really like that Melinda Dillon got, you know, was the one to be nominated from it, because, you know, I don't think it's the best performance in the film. I agree with you, Nathaniel, that Richard Dreyfuss is really extraordinary in it, but she's so, her performance in a way is so representative of what's kind of tonally and rhythmically odd and, as you said, kind of inchoate about the film. And it's so rare for characters that unarticulated to get nominated. I think it was Mark who wrote that it's as easy, if anything, easier to imagine Terry Garr having gotten a nomination for that. And maybe if maybe if her character's arc had been a bit more completed, she would have done. But I think between the two, Melinda Dillon was the right one to choose.
So, speaking of inarticulate characters, we have two, we have two more that we have to get to, and we only have about 10 minutes left. So, I just want to, like, Leslie Brown and Tuesday Weld. Okay, here we have two examples of one character gets a ton of time in her movie, and the other one gets almost none, and yet I feel like I have the whole story of Tuesday Weld's, you know, whirling, manic swinger, and I still understand almost nothing about Amelia the dancer.
You have the whole story of Tuesday Weld because she screams it at you in front of her. It's like... I've never seen someone like come in and sort of start ransacking the room for an Oscar. It was like Geraldine Page in Pope of Greenwich Village level of like, I'm going to make every millisecond count. But, you know, I really like Tuesday Weld a lot. I think the character as written and presented is just monstrous. And I found the movie monstrous too.
Yeah.
I'm weirdly fascinated with this movie. I've seen it a couple times, and I'm seeing it again next month because it's finally showing on the big screen here. At our new theater, the Metrograph, is showing it next month. But I understand why you would call it a hateful artifact, as you did. I read a really interesting defense about its hatefulness recently. And it's a movie that I can always go back to because it's just so strange and confrontational. And I think there's a lot to think about even if you're sort of grossed out by it. But that's true even with, you know, any of the characters in it. And Tuesday Weld, like, I love supporting characters where, I understand what you're saying about she's like shouting her story, but I love supporting characters where you feel like you could theoretically have an entire movie that would be a good movie off to the side if you just followed someone else. Which is what what always makes me feel like the actor is doing a lot with what they're given. When I feel like I could imagine a whole movie. I could do a spin-off movie.
I find that these two last ones that we're looking at, one character has a full storyline for a supporting actor. I think pretty much the only one here, like a full one. And then with Tuesday Weld, she's sort of like relegated to what a lot of, I find, female figures are, which is sort of like a marginal figure, but who's like a warning to a lot of other people. And yet I was sort of more interested in what her sort of backstory was and would have loved to have seen something further drawn out with her. Like, out of all these characters who maybe had very little screen time, I was a lot more, like, I wanted to know more about her, and like, I would watch a film if it was like her sort of angle on everything. Sort of in comparison to Leslie Brown, where she sort of gets a lot more screen time, but I don't really... Like, I was not really invested with her at all. I didn't find her relatable at all. But there's something... Tuesday Weld isn't there for as long, and I really wanted to know more about her.
Guy, what do you think? We haven't heard... I've never heard you talk about Looking for Mr. Goodbar, so I'm curious what you think about it.
I find myself inclined to defend a lot of the film's kind of strange lapses in kind of perspective and tone, especially. I mean, and I do like the film. I don't find it hateful, as Mark says. I still find myself still undecided as to whether it kind of condemns Diane Keaton's behavior and punishes her for it, or whether it condemns the society that punishes her for it. And after seeing it twice now, I'm none the wiser, but I'm really intrigued by it. And in the case of Tuesday Weld, I kind of share Sarah's frustration that we don't see more of her and that we're given such kind of, you know, limited kind of insights into her life. And yet I think that's kind of appropriate in a way, because we're kind of in Diane Keaton's headspace when there's her kind of sister falling apart the time next to her, but she's not really interested. She's off on her own beam. So I think it's fitting that we only get these kind of sudden, shocking kind of glimpses of a life in complete disarray, while Diane Keaton kind of spins on her own beam.
Yeah, I just find it so interesting that it's like these two parallel figures, but they're both complete messes. And then one is presented as sort of, when their scenes are together, it's suddenly like Diane Keaton's not a mess, but we know she is.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's sort of that warning sign that you're supposed to ignore if you're kind of spinning around, like kind of unraveling too.
Mm-hmm. Although to me that gets really interesting in Tuesday Weld's last scene, right before the violent finish, because the character has seemed so stormy and sort of ignorant of everything around her own show. But her antenna goes up immediately, you know, like when she walks into that brownstone, that this is the wrong person and this is a bad encounter. And given the kind of movie it is and the way it's staging things, a lot of people would recognize this is like not a good encounter.
Right.
But the fact that we learn, I feel like, in that scene, not just how it's written, but the way that Weld plays it, that she actually does have some intuition for danger and does seem to understand that her sister is kind of precarious. And so if she's been ignoring those kinds of instincts to be so narcissistic the whole movie, it does kind of change my view of the character than somebody who just has no clue and is off living her own wild life. So I kind of like that bait and switch, and I do think the performance gets a little more complicated in those final impressions.
Well, I'm wondering, because I will fess up here, I don't really know much about Tuesday Weld's career, but I understand she's an actor who has quite a devoted following. So I'm wondering, for people who do really enjoy her, what they would recommend of her work, because like I don't know her career well. I'll just say that.
Well, definitely Pretty Poison from about 10 years earlier is a really strong performance where she's kind of this slightly deranged Lolita-ish ingenue. And I mean, the thing about Tuesday Weld is like she's a device in this movie, but she's such an interesting, weird, idiosyncratic, shrewd actress that she brings this kind of self-awareness and wit and energy to a lot of what she does that gives you that feeling, as Sarah said, that you maybe want to follow her into her own story, because it seems like she has a really interesting story, and that often happens in the handful of movies that she made. If anybody can ever find Play It As It Lays, which is adapted from the Joan Didion book, she's the star of that, and it's really a kind of, to me, essential 70s movie / essential 70s performance.
Mm-hmm. And it's her being so, in many extreme situations, she's playing such a stony, either naturally or performatively impassive, or at least highly aloof person. So the opposite of what you're seeing. It's why the excessiveness of her looking for Mr. Goodbar performance is so surprising to me. Because in a lot of her movies, she's like in Pretty Poison or Lord Love a Duck, she plays this kind of blonde, sometimes literally cheerleader, who everybody around her is reacting to as if she's just kind of a one-dimensional paragon. And then you start to realize how much more complexity or contradiction is in there. But she usually does a whole lot without being particularly demonstrative. So this is like a crazy Tuesday Weld performance.
So very atypical for her, yes. Then. Wow, interesting. Okay, I would love to see more of her stuff. I don't know how much there is to say about Leslie Brown. I feel like is the one where, when reading everyone's takes on it, I was like, okay, I get what everybody. You know, it's like sometimes it's really hard to say in 77 words what you think of a performance.
Yes.
And other times it's like, yep, there isn't a lot more to say. Which is not to say, I think sometimes, you know, they always say casting is like 90% of movies. You know, that's one of those cliches that's not entirely true. But in some cases it is true, and I do think that that's a movie that benefits from the limitations of an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least the movie that can survive them and make something out of them.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what else I have to say about The Turning Point. If anybody else has something, we could say it now, or we could move on to who should have been nominated this year.
my Turning Point. the turning point is if it were made today, and it would never be made today, which is kind of a sad thing in itself. But I was wondering if today, if it were an Oscar movie, would Anne Bancroft be taking Leslie Brown's place in Best Supporting Actress?
And would she? I was actually going to. Yeah.
Yeah, and win. Yeah, because it's really like they really all three of them have pretty equal screen time.
Yeah.
Anne, Leslie, and Shirley. It's a 300 as much as Goodbye Girl is.
Yeah.
Mhm.
I taught a class that was largely centered around the movies of 1977 a couple years ago, in a gender studies department, and we watched Star Wars and Annie Hall and The Turning Point were our first three movies. And I polled them if they had been Oscar voters, what they would have gone for, just trying to get a sense of the room about Annie Hall versus Star Wars. And The Turning Point won in a landslide.
What?
And, yeah, totally. And for anecdotal reasons, I taught one of Mikhail Baryshnikov's daughters, who I stayed in touch with. And briefly, he was going to talk to this class about the movie. And I told her that, you know, turns out this movie is the class's favorite. And she said, "My dad can't understand why that would be. It was Annie Hall, Star Wars, and The Turning Point, and they picked this? He's really surprised."
Well, I feel the closest, like, modern example I can think, there was, like, a ballet movie or a lot of, like, dance films that have sort of come out, never nominated for an Oscar, but I can't really see a film like this being made. I think similar ones where you kind of have, like, a coming of age where it's sort of the lead would definitely be Leslie Brown's character and not the sort of the surrounding figures. Yeah. And the mother figure who was like, I think it was I think it was Center Stage. It was something, or like, there was a film too. There are a couple of them where the mother figure is the supporting role, but she's sort of, you know, trying to push the daughter in a direction, you know, that she sort of longs that she would have had. And I think what made Anne Bancroft.
Black Swan, maybe?
That too, yeah.
Yeah.
I think there was one called Center Stage as well, where it's the ballerina sort of is the lead, sort of Leslie Brown. She's sort of like what Leslie Brown would be, and a mother who, you know, wanted to be a dancer as well, but had children. And, you know, I just think like Anne Bancroft's character, if anything, was a lot more interesting to me because you do have the woman who basically is the embodiment of what the mother wanted and isn't happy either. And you never really get that in sort of modern takes. It's sort of a mother pushing a child, usually a daughter, in a direction that even the child doesn't really know where to go. And I think there's that scene between Anne Bancroft and Leslie Brown where she asks her, "Well, what do you want? Like, which one you want?" And then Leslie can't decide and she says, "Well, you want both." And that's, you know, like, there to have sort of another mediating female figure who's like, "Well, you want it all," which is something that, you know, is pushed on a lot more women today, that kind of idea of having it all and wanting it all. I found that dynamic. Like, you had three women that kind of represented all of that in this film, and you don't really necessarily get that as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I love, of course, because I love actressing. I love movies that are all about women like this. But it does feel like a movie that has way too much going on, or at least not a strong enough handle on all of that, you know, to get all these ideas across. But I do think it's a interesting movie, and I agree that it would not be made today, which always makes me sad.
Yeah.
I was interested to see, I was going back through its awards history, and I saw that, like, the Golden Globes nominated Bancroft but not McLean, and so did the BAFTAs, even though obviously they were after the Oscars in those days. Whereas it seems to me, obviously, especially because Shirley MacLaine was kind of due then and Anne Bancroft was not, that it would have been more kind of her awards vehicle than Bancroft's. And I wonder if anybody sort of remembers or knows from reviews at the time how those two performances were received.
I wasn't following back then, but I mean, watching it now, I was like, it's totally Anne Bancroft's movie to me. I think she's brilliant in it. Whereas the other, everybody else, I think it's either fine or there's something lacking in the performance.
All the reviews from the time I remember reading to teach it were pretty even handed in praising both of them. But I don't know. I feel, about this movie the way I do about most of the ones we're talking about today, that I am impressed that a lot of them, for better or worse, find different ways to kind of inhabit the contradictions that they're about. And that does mean that sometimes character arcs go in odd places or seem like they get dropped, or the movie seems to be speaking out of two sides of its own mouth about what it really thinks about Lillian Hellman or about, you know, having it all as a dancer, former dancer. Mm-hmm. But and all the paradox in Goodbar that we can't tell if it's editorializing for her or against her. But it was, I think, the most refreshing thing about watching this cluster, even when it sometimes suggested flaws in the storytelling, was that they none of them feel particularly resolved. I think there are a couple different ways to take the duel between the stars of The Turning Point, or where the movie's sympathies are or aren't. Like, it's not particularly controlling, and even when it orchestrates this big famous catfight that they make up almost immediately,
right?
There are a lot of funny swerves that I agree with you, Nathaniel, that it can feel like The Turning Point is just taking on a lot, or shutting things a little bit maybe down too quickly. But I also think the movie has a kind of interestingly loose structure, and that it's not totally fixated on shaping it all into a genre shape that we'll know, or...
Mm-hmm. I mean, has there ever been an Oscar year since that has been so completely shaped by female characters?
No, right? I did the research on it. This year, the Best Picture race was basically 80% about women. And there's never been a year like it since. 39 more years.
So the fact that I was born in this year suddenly is teaching me a whole lot.
Yeah, there's almost no years where there's more female pictures. I don't think there are any years where there's more female pictures than male pictures after 1977.
And that every Best Actress nominee is in a Best Picture nominee. I'm not sure that's ever happened. That's
really striking.
Yeah.
And these were studio movies as well. So I think we were saying how The Turning Point wouldn't get made today. And, you know, some of these movies we even talk about today would be made today, but not necessarily in the same way or talking.
Yeah.
Or wouldn't become like, you know, The Goodbye Girl was one of the like top biggest hits of the year, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to wrap up, but I'm curious, like, from your other films that you've seen in 1977, the Academy's acting branch that year had very, very limited... I feel like they didn't get any screeners back in... Well, there wasn't VHS. So, because they, like, four acting nominations for Julia, four for The Turning Point, they have a very, very limited amount of movies that feels like they watched that year.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious what you would have nominated, since we weren't all that impressed with this lineup. I mean, I know the easy one for me is Joan Blondell in Opening Night, who I just think is brilliant in that movie. And I love her, like, I hate actresses moment.
She's incredible in that.
And anybody else?
I think I would have picked either of the two women, Donna Pescau or Karen Lynn Gorney in Saturday Night Fever. I think both of those performances are great and hold up fantastically as the years have gone by. And also, just for the sheer weirdness and because she should have an Oscar nomination somewhere, Shelley Duvall for Three Women.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say Sissy Spacek and Three Women, actually, because I have no idea how to divvy up.
Yeah, that's
in terms of lead and support.
Well, they're both lead.
Yeah,
Three Women.
Or, you know, Janice Rule. I think, you know, someone somewhere should have got a nomination for that film.
I watched Handle with Care last night, which is also called Citizens Band. It's one of Jonathan Demme's first movies, and Anne Wedgworth in it won the National Society of Film Critics Supporting Actress Prize this year. And it's free if you're an Amazon Prime member, and if not, it's cheap to rent. And it's really delightful. It's about this whole community of people in the South who are all on... It's basically an internet movie, but about CB radio. Like, they all have these different personas that they're talking to all the time, not realizing that they all know each other and have really different personas in life than they do on the radio. But like a lot of Jonathan Demme movies from that era, it's Altman-esque in a lot of ways. It's completely spread out among its ensemble of like 14 people. You could program it with Nashville and not feel embarrassed, which you can't say about almost any other movie. But and so there aren't, when I was expecting maybe more showcased roles for Wedgeworth or Marsha Rod, who got some Critics Award support too. But everybody in it is great. And so for the movie as well as the performances, I would push that one. And I also took some of your readers' comments to heart and watched Roseland, which is this early Merchant Ivory movie. It's kind of a three-parter with 3 half-hour stories inside this New York City dance hall. But a lot of people we know from other Oscar-nominated movies like Lilia Scala and Teresa Wright. And then some people I didn't know called Joan Copeland and Helen Gallagher, who got some support from your commenters. They're all quite good, too. So I'd recommend that one.
Oh, good. I will. I mean, I didn't know Handle with Care was easily available, so I will definitely check that one out.
Joan Copeland is Arthur Miller's sister, by the way.
You're kidding! Wow. Nope. That'd be a funny thing to kid about.
Sarah, have you seen a lot from 77?
I was also going to suggest Karen Lynn Gornin from Saturday Night Fever. Gorney, sorry, from Saturday Night Fever. That was my pick as well.
Yeah. I remember there was something about, like, I wasn't really paying attention in the 70s, but I remember, like, in retrospect, there was something about one of the girls in Saturday Night Fever being really angry that her performance wasn't taken seriously. Like, people thinking she actually was that person, and she wasn't doing an accent, and she was doing an accent. Do you remember anything about this? If it was Karen, maybe it was Karen Lynn Gorney. Like, isn't one of the girls from Staten Island or something in the movie?
Is it Donna Pesco?
I don't know.
I mean, they're both Brooklyn girls, aren't they? Isn't it all Brooklyn?
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Old Brooklyn, before anyone had beards.
Yeah, I just remember there was a thing about she was like that she had trouble getting other roles because people thought of her as, like, this Brooklyn girl, but she actually wasn't. It was all an accent that she was doing. Oh. But that's the danger of being a good chameleon when you're a young actor, is sometimes people don't realize that you're actually doing a performance. Any final thoughts on 77?
I just had one thing I wanted to mention, which I think is interesting and really unusual, that year both our Best Actor and Best Actress winners, Richard Dreyfuss and Diane Keaton, both won for fairly vivid, high-key comic performances. And in each case, their campaign was surely abetted by a much kind of more low-key, dramatic performance, whereas it seems so much more often that would be the reverse.
Yeah, did Oscar need to laugh that year, or was it, you know, just happenstance? I wonder what happened.
I think Guy is right, though, to say that they were abetted, because I do remember a lot of press after Looking for Mr. Goodbar came out, people saying, you know, my God, Diane Keaton can do anything. She can go from Annie Hall to this. I mean, that was a big part of the Oscar narrative, to the extent that one existed for her. And I think Close Encounters was maybe less a part of that narrative for Dreyfuss, but the fact it opened in December 1977 and people thought he was terrific, and the fact that you know, he was out there as a sort of newly minted 2-in-1 movie star probably pushed him past Richard Burton, who I think was the other person for Equus who was considered to have a real shot that year.
And his career honors, which kept getting, you know, messed up by other Oscar narratives.
Since the Richard Dreyfuss was the Alicia Vikander of 1977.
Somebody should tell him.
I get the feeling he wouldn't like any comparison to any actor besides himself.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for doing this little experiment with me. Next month, the SmackDown will be returning with 1984. So if any of you want to play along at home, start watching those movies now. And we do recommend, like, that even though some of these movies have issues, it is kind of a fascinating quintet, despite some of our qualms with the films. Thanks again to Mark Harris.
Thank you.
Nick Davis.
Sure thing.
Guy Lodge.
fun as always.
And Sarah Black McCullough.
Thank you so much.
Happy movie watching. And let us know in the comments what you think of these performances, these films. If you learned anything, or if you feel like we should have mentioned something else, let us know. And thanks for tuning in.